Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly Utah news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, we'll be discussing Utah's ongoing surge in coronavirus cases and in hospitalizations from COVID-19, as well as the state's new strategy to address the pandemic. Also, with Utah voters receiving ballots, we talk about the advice offered by elections officials and about some of what's on your ballot. And as the election draws closer, Senator Mitt Romney decries American politics as a vile, vituperative, hate-filled morass. He hopes for a better political discourse in the future, and don't we all? Joining me by phone this morning is Salt Lake Tribune government and politics editor Dan Harry. Good morning, Dan, and welcome.
Good morning, Roger.
Thanks for being here. Also on the phone, we've got reporter Aaron Alberti, and good morning to you, Aaron.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here as well. And also on the phone right now, we've got news columnist Robert Gerke. And hi, Robert. Thanks for joining as well.
Hey, thank you, Roger. Good morning.
Listeners, if you'd like to submit questions and comments about the stories we are covering today, you can call 801-355-TALK, or you can tweet your questions and comments to @KCPW. We're going to begin with coronavirus. And Aaron Alberti, you have been following the numbers on the pandemic from the beginning. We're in the midst of what you might call a spike, or maybe a sort of high plateau in cases at this point, a spike in some other metrics. I thought I'd start just by asking you to tell us where we are on those metrics. There's the case count, the rate of positives, hospitalizations. None of them are looking very good right now, right?
No, they're all pretty much as high as they've been. We are still in a slight, and I hate to call it a lull because we're talking about lives here.
Right.
The death count hasn't been, at least at this point, is not reflecting the surge in cases, in large part because that surge in cases was driven by infections among younger adults who are less susceptible to serious illness. However, now we have seen for the last couple of weeks cases really, really spiking among the older groups, and as a result, a lot more hospitalizations. Mm-hmm. Hospitalizations now are at by far their highest point so far during the pandemic. And cases still are coming in each day with, 7-day averages as high as they've ever been as well. So it's not great. Yeah. And because hospitalizations and deaths tend to lag behind new diagnoses by usually 7 to 10 days for hospitalizations and 2 to 3 weeks for deaths. Because of that, the fact that we're still seeing increases means that it seems almost inevitable that hospitalizations are very likely to continue to rise even beyond where they're at now.
To get worse. In terms of rates of cases, we're really high up there when it comes to the list of states. I mean, fifth in the country, according to some analysis. It's just not looking good, as you're saying. And some locations, Aaron, tell me if this is right, but some counties or health districts in Utah are doing, a lot worse than others. Is that correct to say?
Yeah, but pretty much most of the state, at least by the scales that they're using nationally, most of the state is way, way up there, even rural areas. The worst places still for, per capita infections still are mostly along the Wasatch Front. But now, St. George is really spiking. And the Southwest Utah, Central Utah, which is very rural, is having their worst counts yet. And some of the counties there per capita have higher rates even than like Utah County. However, we're talking really small counties. So
sure.
Like a few families get it, and that's going to push them, percent wise up pretty high, pretty fast. But there aren't a lot of exceptions. So far, the Tri-County area near Vernal, they're still doing okay, it seems. However, their local counts yesterday were pretty high. So, yeah, I think the idea that, sure, there are some pretty remote places that are going to be relatively
lower.
They're not going to be nearly as affected by the surge in the urban areas. But, you know, I mean, this isn't pioneer times where everyone's riding horses and carriages. We all have a lot of interaction with each other, and the whole state is surging. I mean, and some of these smaller places, it just doesn't take much for a big portion of their population to get it.
All right. Well, the governor of the state of Utah decried what's happening in the state, this spike, and he said that our healthcare system was at risk of being overrun. Before we get into the strategy, I actually want to play a clip of some of what Governor Gary Herbert said on Tuesday during a news conference. Take a quick listen to this.
Our hospitals are getting overwhelmed, and our healthcare workers are getting stretched too thin to provide the best possible care. We're now utilizing 15.8% of our ICU beds to treat COVID-19 patients today, and our total ICU utilization is now at 69.6%. This leaves our hospitals precariously close to being unable to treat COVID patients in need of critical care and to also provide emergency care to Utahns experiencing other life-threatening conditions. University of Utah's ICU is now at 95% utilization this week. We're having one of the worst outbreaks in the country, and this is unacceptable.
So unacceptable, Aaron Alberti. The governor also said we needed to change things up, and so he announced a new strategy. Maybe you can just tell us what this is and how it differs from what we have been doing.
Okay, well, just to kind of start, what we had been doing was this color-coded system, and it was like red, orange, yellow, green. Pretty much most of the state was at yellow, which was deemed low risk, and then there were some places that were green. Recently, a couple of towns in Utah County got moved to orange because of a major outbreak associated with, you know, college-age adults there. But the labels on that system with, you know, high, moderate, low risk didn't necessarily reflect what was going on epidemiologically. It was more of a restriction level designation. I'm not sure that that was clear to a lot of the general public. And of course, under that system, it was mostly guided by, at least the higher levels were guided by requests from local officials to the government saying, oh, can we go back up to orange so that we can impose more restrictions? And then some of the lowering local officials saying, oh, can we go down to green so we can have fewer restrictions?
Right.
The new system much more firmly attaches whatever level each county is at to the actual case numbers there and infection and positivity rates there, as well as hospitalization levels statewide. So there's not as much like case-by-case decision-making in with this. The restriction levels also, they're not color-coded. They're just, you know, high, moderate, and low. But that's probably the biggest change. But there's also a lot of changes as to what actual restrictions are attached to each level.
Can I ask, Aaron?
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. I you know, you said that it kind of takes away the decision making, or not takes away, but you know, you have these metrics, and if you're in a county that crosses a certain threshold in those metrics, do certain things start happening automatically? And maybe at the same time you can explain those metrics. I think people's eyes can kind of glaze over, but this isn't actually all that complicated what these metrics are, right?
Sure, yeah. So basically there are three things that they're looking at. One is the percent of tests that come back positive over the course of a week. And that's because if that number is high, then that suggests that a lot of people are infected that aren't getting tested, that they're not using testing as like a check to make sure people aren't infected. It's more like, oh, yeah, you probably got it. Let's test you. So that suggests a likelihood of spread going on, kind of that we're not presently aware of. The second of those criteria is how many people have been diagnosed in the last 2 weeks per population. So what percentage of people are getting it in the last 2 weeks? And then the third is how heavily utilized the intensive care units in the state's hospitals are. So how many patients, you know, versus capacity, as well as how many of those patients are there for coronavirus. So that's what determines where you're at. And if you're above a certain level for two of those three things, then you go to either high, moderate, or low levels of transmission. That's kind of your designator that decides what levels of restrictions you're under in your county.
Could I jump in just for
sure.
a second?
Yeah, Dan Harry
I'm looking at that chart now, and it's interesting that Garfield County, which really is one of the smallest counties in the state, is number three on this list for the high infection rate. And that would not have been reflected under the previous color coding, which would have shown it with very light restrictions. And it also kind of makes you question the ICU utilization measurement they're doing, because while they have it for each county, it's the same statewide. It's the same percentage, 69.6. So I'm not sure that that's really valuable as a county measurement.
And is it not? Actually, Aaron, that's a question that I have, is when they talk about the ICU utilization as one of the metrics that they're measuring, is it by county or is it statewide ICU utilization?
No, it's that all of the ICU criteria is statewide.
Huh.
So basically, once the ICU measures pass the threshold for whatever, any county that has either one of the other two things is going to be like there. So if we get above 72% ICU utilization and 15% of those patients are there for coronavirus, then any county that has either of the other two criteria is going to automatically be high. But the ICU thing, I personally, as a reporter, have found this a little frustrating because, you know, we have ICU units at hospitals in a lot of different places, and I'm not sure if, you know, let's say it's at 75% or something. If all of the free beds are in St. George, then that's not really going to help somebody in Brigham City. And we don't know how they're distributed, and the hospital systems have been very tight-lipped about, you know, releasing information. I know that there's a lot of things that, you know, hospital systems can do, and that the hospitals are working together to make sure that patients are distributed in a way that, you know, no one place is going to be needlessly overwhelmed.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, if we're talking about shipping people from the Wasatch Front down to St. George or something, or, you know, wherever else, I just don't know that that tells me a lot as a reporter. That's my concern, just as sort of a side issue.
Sure. I mean, the governor did say that, I mean, just on the idea of the fact that hospitals are already doing a certain degree of what he called load leveling, where they're moving people between hospitals,
yeah,
even between health systems, and then also said that the National Guard and the health department were on standby to open up a field hospital at the Mountain America Expo Center in Sandy, Utah. Stark ideas of what might be happening. And some of this is because we are, again, as you pointed out, in this very elevated, as elevated as we've seen in terms of numbers. Can you talk, Aaron, a little bit about the emphasis on mask wearing and what happens when you move from, say, the low to the moderate or the moderate to the high level in a county? How does that happen? I mean, not you meet those thresholds and you make that change, but then what is required of you in a county when that happens?
Sure. Well, so for now, they're doing what they're calling a two-week circuit breaker, basically elevated restrictions for a lot of different things, not just masks, in most of the state. Right now, only 8 of our counties are in, like, the low level on this scale, and they're mostly kind of rural, remote counties. So everyone else is in moderate or high, and everyone in moderate or high is living in a county where masks are supposed to be mandated until the 29th of October. Now, after that, if you're in the moderate level, that's no longer the case after the 29th. But in the high level, all the counties in the high level, and there are six right now, so that could change next week. That those people, those counties, are supposed to have mask mandates.
What about what happens with
the... It does make you wonder, though, if, like, Garfield County is... If people are wearing masks in Garfield County, it makes you wonder.
Well, I mean, I'm wondering even within Salt Lake County. I mean, I know, you know, I mean, there are some neighborhoods in Salt Lake County that if you look at the local data, their transmission rates aren't that high. But if you go into southern Salt Lake County, their rates are spiking right up there with Utah counties. And Utah County and Salt Lake County have both had a mask order for a little bit. They did achieve declines after imposing them, but I'm not sure if I'm not sure how steady enforcement has been, you know, especially within private businesses, stores and whatnot.
Enforcement hasn't, I mean, that's not really a big part of that, of this new strategy that the governor has forward. And this is something that columnist Robert Gierke wrote about as well in his column. So I'll bring him into the conversation just quickly. Robert, you, you know, you had this column on the new metrics and what was happening and the new strategy from the state. And your one word lead to that column was finally. Does that mean that you're happy to see these changes? Can you talk about that?
These changes are better than nothing, which is what we had before. I was disappointed that it took, I mean, I wrote 3 weeks ago that the governor should have taken many of these steps, including the mask mandates for the counties with high rates of transmission. And if he had done it 3 weeks ago, we might be seeing some effect of it. You got to remember any intervention you make against a virus like this, you're already behind the curve because you're already 10 to 14 days until you start seeing some impacts of it. And so, you know, there's no reason to think that we're going to suddenly see a flattening or downward trajectory on this. And, you know, and that has consequences down the line. As Aaron mentioned, the hospitalizations, as we have seen throughout this across the world and in Utah, the hospitalizations follow the case increases and then deaths follow the hospitalizations. And so, you know, the failure to act for 34 days and really longer than that, because it's just taking effect today, has some serious consequences. And I think we're seeing, you know, record cases most of the days for the last 2 weeks for each given day. And so, it was unfortunate that the governor took so long to finally act. I think the masks in these moderate to high counties is important. I wish there would be an enforcement mechanism. He kind of put it to the locals, and we've heard the Brigham City or the Box Elder County Sheriff, the Utah County Sheriff, several of these law enforcement agencies are saying that they're not going to enforce it. That matters to some degree, but I think, you know, I've heard from businesses that they want a mask mandate because then they can tell their customers that they have to wear it, and it's not the business, it's the bad guy, it's the government. You know, in Salt Lake County, we haven't really had aggressive, active enforcement. And you know, there's reason to believe that when it was put into place originally, it worked. I'm not sure that it's working quite as effectively now, although, you know, the places we are seeing the spread, and the reason that the governor put these limitations on casual gatherings, as Aaron mentioned, it, you know, 10 people at a casual gathering, a backyard barbecue kind of event, is because that's where we're seeing most of the spread now. And so that's what they're trying to target. And you know, I kind of finished that column with, we better hope it works, because we're kind of running out of time and running out of options before we start seeing reaching a real crisis level in the emergency room. Yeah. And just one thing to kind of put this into perspective, this month so far we've had over 16,000 cases. You know, we're racking up over 1,200 a day now for the last week. And six out of every 1,000 people since this virus started spreading in Utah has died. And so you can do 6 times 16 and you get 96 deaths that we're going to see. coming down the pike at us. And that's assuming that our hospitals can keep up with the flood of people coming in. We have things called crisis standards of care, which is what, how hospitals triage patients as they come through the door. And they reach a point down the road that you start denying care to people who have pre-existing conditions or who are old and are unlikely to recover from this, so you can treat the people who have the best chances of recovery. And that's a scary prospect, but that's the reality that that we could be facing if we don't get our hands around this thing.
Wow. Well, and consider that coronavirus is not the only thing putting pressure on the hospital systems right now. We're beginning flu season. And I know people hear the flu, they think everyone's had the flu, it's not that big. But of course, I mean, for every X number of people who get the flu, some of them are going to end up in the hospital. That always goes up every year. That puts pressure on hospitals, and any margin that has been kind of built into those resources is being chewed up by coronavirus this year.
I mean, it's heading towards a kind of frightening winter, is by the sounds of it. One thing that I wanted to get to just before we head to a break, and Aaron, maybe we can wrap up here, is when we talk about these levels of, you know, low, moderate, or high, what happens with schools when a county moves into, say, the high transmission level? Do schools close, or what happens there?
No, schools kind of have their own metrics and their own guidelines, so this doesn't really affect schools opening, closing.
And okay, so they make decisions based on other factors. How many students, for example, have tested positive, or the kind of outbreak that might happen? Is that correct?
Yeah, the state has recommended if a school has more than 15 cases within 2 weeks, that they should go to online only. However, I think the majority of schools, I mean, I'm almost certain the majority of schools that have reached that point have actually not done that. Several districts have set up their own standards, like, for example, a certain percentage of students, because some of these high schools are really, really big, and 15 isn't as big a percentage of them as it would be at, say, an elementary school. So some of them have changed it to where they just have to have a lot more students get it before, or not just students, I should say staff. Although I will say, like, for example, high schools, they closed down because they really couldn't operate anymore because so many of their teachers were on quarantine. So, yeah, different districts are doing different things.
And just lastly, on the topic of masks, which we were talking about before, there are a variety of counties now that are in that high level, and in every indoor setting in those counties, they have to be wearing masks. I mean, masks are mandatory. Is that correct?
Yeah, in public. I mean, people aren't required to wear them in their own home.
Got it.
Yeah, if they go to a store building or something.
I'm not certain what the six counties are, but there are six. I know that Salt Lake County is in there.
Utah County, Salt Lake, Garfield, Juab, and Cache. And Wasatch.
I'm going to let
we all heard of yelling counties there. Sorry about that.
Dan, why don't you tell us that again? I'll give it to you.
It's Utah County is first, Salt Lake County, Garfield, Juab, Cache, and Wasatch.
Okay. Hopefully our listeners feel caught up on the new strategy. And Aaron Alberti, I'll say thank you for your thorough coverage of this and for bringing us up to speed. We need to head to our first break, and there is still more to come, including questions about voting answered and a look at the constitutional amendments on your ballot. You're tuned to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, featuring reporting from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune government and politics editor Dan Harry, reporter Aaron Alberti, and news columnist Robert Gerke, all via the phone. It is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can call us to join this conversation as well. The number to call, 801-355-8255, or you can tweet to @KCPW, and we will look for your comments and questions there. The November 3rd election is now just 2 weeks from this coming Tuesday. Many people are on edge as they're heading into it, and we'll get to what Senator Mitt Romney thinks of the political climate in America in just a little bit. But first, let's talk about some of the, I don't know, the mechanics of voting this time around. We are, after all, as we were just discussing, in a pandemic. Dan Harry from the Government and Politics Desk. Ballots are arriving. I got mine in my mailbox just earlier this week on Wednesday. Elections officials are saying, hey, use those mail-in ballots, and they also don't want you to sit on them for very long. What's the advice that elections officials are giving, and why, Dan?
Nationally, they're saying, you know, you want to get it in as the ballots in as soon as possible, at least a week before the election, the November 3rd election. Locally, they're talking about the Friday before the election. So that gives, a several-day cushion. And one of the strange things about this election, which I'm worried will throw off some people, is that in the primary, you could mail your ballots right up to and through Election Day. So as long as it was postmarked by the Election Day, which in that case was June 30, you were okay. Your ballot would be counted, wouldn't be counted Election Day, but it would be counted before the canvass. Now, the legislature has not extended that to the general election, so your ballot has to be postmarked the day before the election. And I'm just a little worried that a lot of people will not understand that they have to get that in before the election. They cannot mail it on Election Day.
And I mean, I guess that's probably part of the reason for the advice to turn it in on the Friday before Election Day. You can turn them in. If you don't mail them in by the day, you know, by the day before November 2nd, get them postmarked, that is, by that day, you could also take them to a drop box, Dan? Is that correct?
Right.
Okay.
That is correct, yeah. There will be drop boxes, and they have quite a few, especially in more populous areas in Salt Lake County. I can't remember what the exact number is, but there are a good number of drop boxes. Those lists are available on the county clerk's website. You can find where they are. And there's probably one close to you. Yeah, so you can actually drop those in on Election Day, and the question is, do you want to do that and take a risk that your car is going to break down or something else? But you know, generally speaking, it's a good idea to mail your ballot in early.
Got it. The Salt Lake County clerk was pretty direct about the reason for the advice that she was giving about voting early and voting by mail, especially the voting by mail part. It's because she's worried that polling locations could become a place where we could see the spread of coronavirus, right? I mean, that's the whole reason behind this.
She talked about, Sherry Swenson, the county clerk, talked about how if you're following social distancing, which the clerk intends to try to help enforce of these polling places, you're talking about a 6-foot between each person. Well, that line becomes extremely long when you're giving that kind of distance between each person in it. So it becomes sort of unwieldy.
I suppose we should mention that that you can register to vote online through October 23rd, and you can do that at voter.utah.gov. And then there's a lot of election information at vote.utah.gov. But voter.utah.gov is where you can register if you have not. More ballots are being sent out than ever before in the state. I spoke with the state elections director, Justin Lee, about that myself this week, and he said that it's not because of the pandemic. It's just by chance that that voting by mail in Utah was already set to expand. When do those ballots actually start getting counted, Dan Harry? I mean, they have to wait till Election Day to count. Is that correct?
Well, they have to wait to Election Day to count, to release the count.
Okay, yeah.
They don't release the count until after the polling places have actually closed. But I think they start counting before
I'm not
Election
certain.
Day. I'm not sure. I mean, it makes sense that they would, right?
Yeah.
They do process the ballots. They won't announce any results until after polls close.
Okay. I want to get to some of what's on the ballot as well. Obviously, you know, the candidates for president and there are various local and statewide elections. I'm actually going to skip all of the candidates because there are a lot of resources out there on that. And I want to zero in on the the constitutional amendments that are on the ballot. There are seven of them. And news columnist Robert Gierke, I know that you've been digging into these amendments. And I'm going to admit to you that I have not yet filled out this part of my ballot because I don't know what they really some of them are about. And so I was wondering if we could go through these one by one to understand them. Constitutional Amendment A. This is pretty straightforward, making constitutional language gender neutral, so that it's not, you know, every man in the state, but every person in the state.
Yeah, that's right. That's what it is. It was non-controversial. It passed unanimously in the legislature. But it does have to be ratified by voters, and it's pretty straightforward.
Okay, and then Amendment B, not exactly as straightforward. This has to do with requirements for candidates for office and when those requirements apply. What would this one do?
Well, there are standards for eligibility to serve, to be elected or appointed in the House and Senate, and it just clarifies that the qualifications apply to the date of the election or appointment, not beforehand. So it's mostly codifying something that's or putting in the Constitution, I guess, clarifying language that's already in statute.
Okay, that is a little bit more straightforward than I expected. Constitutional Amendment C removes language in the Utah Constitution that allowed slavery as a punishment for crime. Tell us about this one, Gierke.
This one's pretty straightforward, too. I mean, right now the Constitution allows slavery and involuntary servitude as criminal punishment. So it just deletes that language from the Constitution.
All right. Let's keep going. Constitutional Amendment D. This one's utterly opaque to me and has to do with water rights and how cities provide water. Can you shed any light on that, Robert?
So this one is a lot more complicated. So right now the Constitution doesn't explicitly allow cities to sell water outside their boundaries. And so if you think about it, Salt Lake City has this sort of vast water system that provides water to a lot of the Salt Lake Valley. Basically, it's allowing the city to giving the city permission to provide water outside of their jurisdiction, which they already are doing. So it's sort of more, again, formalizing or allowing in the Constitution something that has been taking place for quite some time.
Hmm. Okay. We've got three more left. Amendment E has to do with hunting, but again, I don't quite understand what it's all about or what it aims to do. What is this one, Gierke?
Yeah, so this one, I spoke to the sponsor about this during the session. He said that the reason he's sponsoring this amendment is because in other states there have been voter initiatives, ballot initiatives to try to restrict hunting. Groups like PETA and the Humane Society have gotten behind these in other states. And he's worried about something like that coming here. Obviously, it's not happened yet, and hunting is you know, I don't think it's under much threat. But he wants something in the Constitution to make clear that this is the that hunting is a constitutional right.
Can I add something there? And,
yeah.
You know, it's kind of strange because there's really right now not any existent threat of anybody doing this. And also, if you remember a few years back, we passed a constitutional amendment that requires a sportsman or fishing restriction initiative to pass by 2/3 of the voter of the general public. The only one that does that. So the legislature is really concerned about preserving this right, which really doesn't seem to be under any threat.
Is it?
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. Go ahead and opine.
Oh yeah, I agree with Dan. It's not really under threat. I think this is a little bit more for show. One could make it a reasonable argument that things that are done as statements or for show shouldn't necessarily be in the Constitution of the state. You know, it's a big step to take for something that is a message.
A message constitutional amendment. I've never actually heard of that. Is there any?
Do you remember the ban on gay marriage?
Oh,
message.
I suppose I have heard of it. good point, Dan. But the is this language coming from? You know, is this like a cut and paste constitutional amendment coming from some different source, or is it you know, straight from the sponsor's mind, Gerke?
You know, that's an interesting question. I mean, I know the National Rifle Association is supporting this and some of the hunting and fishing groups, but I don't know, honestly, if there are other states that have gone down this road. Sorry.
Okay. Nope, you're fine. Amendment F now we'll go on to. This one has language that I can understand. Right now, the annual legislative session has to start on the fourth Monday in January each year. This would allow lawmakers to adjust the start date each year. For when? I mean, would they just arbitrarily choose a date, or how would that happen, Gerke?
It wouldn't be arbitrary. It would have to be done in statute, so they would have to set the date either, you know, in the session prior or in a special session. And this is kind of something they've been talking about for a while. If you remember, they pushed the start date back. Dan, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe it was the second Monday in January. And they pushed it back 2 weeks because they wanted a little bit of extra time to kind of get the budget numbers lined up, you know, get the revenue estimates in. And so this would just give them a little bit more flexibility.
Yep.
I haven't heard of any specific date that they're targeting to start the sessions or to move the sessions to.
If you remember, for years we started the session on Martin Luther King Jr. Day. And a lot of folks complained that that should not be the case, that the legislature should respect and observe the holiday like others. And the legislature always made the argument that, oh, no, this is a way for us to celebrate that day. Eventually, the arguments against it won over, and they moved the session back. And this just gives them more flexibility, like Robert said.
Is there an argument to be made for them not having more flexibility? I mean, obviously, it makes it harder to plan, you know, coverage as a news organization, but you know, you can't say on this exact date we're going to start our legislative, send our legislative reporters up the hill. But I guess what's the problem this is trying to fix?
Well, I don't know that there is much of a problem,
okay,
to be honest. I think it's just a matter of they've been talking about starting the session later in the year, or, you know, adjusting it according to, you know, certain conditions or certain needs that they have. But again, it doesn't change the duration of the session. It's still 45 days, and you know, so it's just providing a little bit more flexibility and not having a hard definitive start time in the Constitution. You know, it's just giving a little bit more ability.
If you look at the voter information pamphlets, it kind of gives you a clue as to which ones are controversial, and some of them have no arguments submitted against them. This is one of those. Nobody felt compelled to write something arguing that this should not be passed.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry, Roger. By the way, I just noticed that there is legislation that would move the start date from the fourth Monday in January to the third Tuesday in January. So they're actually looking at moving it up by almost a week, just after Martin Luther King Day now.
Well, let's move on to the final one, Amendment G. This is the constitutional amendment I've seen the most, organizing around. Has to do with changing the earmark for education funding to some extent, to a minor extent. But tell us about this one.
Yeah, this is the one that is, I guess, the most controversial. It's also probably the most complicated. If you remember back in, you know, back before COVID, which seems like years ago, the legislature tried to reform its tax structure. And the problem that they were having was that all of the income tax money right now is supposedly earmarked to public and higher education. The sales tax that funds everything else, like roads and police, or roads and highway patrol and corrections and things like that, wasn't growing as fast. And so they were trying to get some more flexibility. The way they passed a tax bill that got a lot of public backlash that they repealed. So the way they're looking for flexibility now is they're going to add programs for children and disabled individuals to the income tax revenue stream. What that means is that, you know, instead of having that pie cut just between higher and public ed, it will now be cut more ways. They have made assurances to the legislature has made assurances to the teachers union, to the, you know, to the Board of Education and so forth, that they will provide it on a level of funding. They're going to fund at least the growth in the number of students and an inflationary adjustment. To make sure that education isn't harmed by this dividing it different ways, but by taking these programs out of the sales tax revenue stream and putting them into the income tax revenue stream, they think that they can free up, I believe the number was $600 million that they will then be able to spend on other things. The opposition to this is coming from groups that are saying, well, you're not actually changing the size of the pie, you're just slicing it into different slices, and there's going to be winners and losers. And by pitting these programs for children and disabled against higher education and public education, you're going to be undermining the revenue, or at least making it less certain that all three of these will benefit. So that's the opposition. Again, the UEA bought into this agreement during the session because they felt like that assurance that they would get at least enrollment growth and an inflationary adjustment every year was worth the trade-off, and frankly that they were in a little bit of a pickle because the legislature made clear that if they didn't go along with this, there were ways that they could change the income tax, take money out of the income tax, and use it for other things that would maybe harm education and give the legislature what they wanted anyway.
So this was, again, part of a deal, as you said, struck by the Utah Education Association. But there are a number of people who are advocating against it, and those who are advocating for it. I'm sorry to cut you short. We're running low on time, Gerke.
Yeah.
And I want to get a question in that a listener called in to ask, and I didn't get to get the phone call in. It's somebody wanted clarification on that hunting constitutional amendment, Constitutional Amendment E. There's a second part of it that says establish public hunting and fishing as the preferred way of managing and controlling wildlife. What does that actually mean, the preferred way? Is there a different way of managing and controlling wildlife?
Yeah, well, I mean, and it's a very good point. For example, if we wanted to control a population, one way you might want to do that is perhaps to sterilize the animals, right, so they don't reproduce. But this would say, no, hunting is the preferred way. It doesn't say it's the only way, and there are, you know, but it does raise the possibility where there are other options on the table that you're weighing, that hunting becomes, again, constitutionally the preferred way to manage those populations. And so it does raise some potential, I guess, conflicts in terms of how populations are managed, and it applies, as I understand, just to all wildlife. We're not just talking about, we're not just talking about deer and elk. It's a much broader thing than that. I don't know if that answered the caller's question, but that's my understanding of how that would work.
I think it definitely added some clarification. We are going to skip our final break in the show here, and I wanted to turn to a story that I teased at the outset, which was the idea that Senator Mitt Romney is not happy with the state of American politics. And Dan Harry, government and politics editor, we don't have a ton of time left, but what did our senator, you know, he's especially calling out the president of the United States for some of the things that he's been saying, but can you fill us in on why Senator Mitt Romney is unhappy with the state of American politics, as though we need reminding?
Well, as you said, he kind of condemned the modern politics for going down in the gutter, but then when you read his actual statement, it's mainly aimed at President Trump. He complained about the president recently referring multiple times to the vice presidential candidate, Kamala Harris, as a monster. He had called the Speaker of the House and uses this regularly as crazy Nancy Pelosi. He's called on the Justice Department to put Barack Obama in jail. And he attacked the Michigan governor on the same day they announced and uncovered the plot of this right-wing militia group to kidnap her.
And so while he kind of included others in this, saying, oh, well, the House Speaker tore up the State of the Union address on television at the State of the Union, he really was aiming most of this criticism at the president. And it seems that it's an indictment of how the president's activities, which some have excused as, oh, that's just his style, is kind of dragging down the whole tenor of political debate in this country.
You know, I don't want to, maybe I'm just going to turn to the columnist here for a minute, Robert Gehrke, news columnist. I don't want to normalize the, you know, the what appears to be bizarre state of things in any way, shape, or form, but politics in America doesn't exactly normally feel cordial either. The Tribune's Robert Gehrke just today had a column about the history of mudslinging in presidential politics in America.
Robert Kirby, you mean.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, I meant Kirby. Yeah, I think I just said Gehrke. That's what I mean. Robert Kirby did that. And then, I don't know, Gehrke, I'm going to go to you, though. Romney and other political observers out there say that this is different, that this is worse than it used to be. What do you see?
Well, I mean, yes, we've had, you know, even since the beginning of the country, if you John Adams and Thomas Jefferson had a heated rivalry where they were accusing each other of fathering illegitimate children and on and on and on. This is, you know, dirty politics is not new. But I think what Senator Romney points to is that it seems to have reached a crescendo leading up to this election, and it's not constructive. And, you know, when we're talking about, good grief, the president, the loser of the election, unwilling to vacate the White House and have a peaceful transition of power, that's something we've never had before. So I think he's trying to just highlight that, you know, let's turn it down a little bit. You know, we've still all got to get along after this is over. And I kind of agree with Dan. There's some both sidesism in Senator Romney's statement, but I do think that most of the criticism was directed at President Trump, which is kind of remarkable coming from a former presidential candidate, Republican presidential nominee. So, you know, I think, you know, the question, as often is the case when Mitt Romney says something, is, so what? What's he going to do about it? And right now, it doesn't look like there's much he can do about it other than say, hey, let's try to knock it off a little bit. But I think it's important. I think more members of Congress, more politicians should be stepping forward and saying, hey, you know, this isn't healthy. This isn't constructive. But there is no indication that any of this is going to do anything to de-escalate the sort of the rising animosity that we're seeing in our political rhetoric.
Dan Harry, I guess, you know, we're running low on time here, so maybe I'll just have you sort of sum up any other additional points from the story that might be of interest. I noticed that Romney had a kind of subtle compliment for the Democratic nominee, Joe Biden.
He was saying that Joe Biden didn't stoop as low as others in his party. And again, he really wasn't mentioning any names there on the Democratic side. But again, it seemed clear to me that this was aimed mainly at the president and his influence on the political dialogue.
Okay, Dan Harry, thanks for that very much. And we now have to turn to our final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week. And let's bring Aaron Alberti back in. We've kept you quiet since before the first break. Aaron, what is your pick for underplayed story? Assuming I've still got you on the line.
Well, if you go to our website right now, you will see a story by Courtney Tanner about an 18-year-old evicted from student housing because she told her roommate that she was having suicidal thoughts, and the roommate reported her to the landlord, and this was deemed a violation of student housing rules.
Wow.
And so she's being evicted during this time.
Wow. Well, I want to see the renter's contract. That's very weird. Columnist Robert Gehrke, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
Yeah, Aaron just stole the one I was going to say, but
sorry.
Since we're talking about elections, I think this has been interesting. Zach Podmore's had a couple pieces. He has one today about Santee County had a ballot glitch where they didn't put a signature line on the ballots. And it turns out the company that printed these ballots, this is not the first time that they've had mistakes in the ballots. It's creating some confusion, and clerks are telling are having to send postcards to every voter telling them to just sign the back of the ballot where the line would be. But this is, you know, it's a headache and probably not something we need. It creates confusion in an already sort of, you know, heightened election season. So you can check that out at fltrib.com.
All right. And Dan Harry, government and politics editor, your pick.
Well, I'm going to go with the story about Burgess Owens, who is challenging Ben McAdams in the 4th District, raising a ton of money. They just had their campaign finance disclosure deadline yesterday, and he's raised $2.5 million in the most recent three-month period, which is remarkable. It might be some sort of record.
Wow.
You know, this is seen as one that could be one of the close races in the country for the U.S. House. And Republicans are really coming out with their wallets for Burgess Owens.
Always a competitive race, that particular seat. Thanks, Dan, for that. I'm going to go with my part, with a story by reporter Leah Larson about the ongoing saga of this town called Hideout. This is a town in Wasatch County, but which wants to scoop up about 350 acres in Summit County's Richardson flat, that is, all without Summit County's consent. And the latest is that a judge on Thursday ruled against Summit County's attempt to block that expansion, and that means that Hideout can officially absorb these hundreds of new acres and build a new town center there. You can check that out and all of the stories we've been covering at sltrib.com. And I will say, Aaron Alberti, Dan Harry, and Robert Gerke, all with the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for joining me on the show today.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
That does it for Behind the Headlines, a co-production of KCPW and The Tribune. You can find podcasts at kcpw.org or in your podcast app. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks again for tuning in and have a great weekend. Join us again next Friday.